This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for watching or listening. Tariff is the most beautiful word in the dictionary, says Donald Trump, who made many promises throughout the 2024 presidential race to raise the cost of imports from China, Mexico, and Canada, America's three biggest trading partners. But are Trump's tariffs a good idea or a terrible one? And is the era of free trade coming to a close? That's the topic of today's Reason interview. And my guest is Dartmouth economist Douglas Irwin, author of Trade Policy Disaster, The Definitive Treatment of the Smoot-Hawley Tariffs, which has just been reissued, and Free Trade Under Fire, now in its fifth edition. We talk about the negative impacts of the tariffs that Trump levied in his first term, why Presidents Bush, Obama, and Biden also trafficked in protectionism, and why free trade is always under attack despite its overall benefits. Here is the Reason interview with Douglas Irwin. Douglas Irwin, thanks for talking to Reason.
Great pleasure to be here.
So you have a reissue of a book that you originally wrote in 2011 called Trade Policy Disaster, Lessons from the 1930s about the Smoot-Hawley tariffs and related legislation. And not too long ago, about 4 years ago, you published the fifth edition of your book, Free Trade Under Fire. Let's just start with that. Why does Free Trade Under Fire, published in the early 2000s when this argument had been won, why does it keep needing new editions?
Well, because it's always under fire, regardless of the time and circumstance, so it seems, but the arguments keep changing. So I originally wrote that, or the impetus was the battle in Seattle, the protests against the WTO summit in Seattle in 1999. And there were just so many anti-globalization, anti-free trade protesters and arguments that were being made that I didn't think were, you know, meritorious, that I thought there's no book out there that sort of puts this together and makes the case for free trade and sort of combat some of the arguments against it. So that was sort of, you know, as environmentalists and, you know, anti, you know, big international organizations. But then, you know, then we had sort of, you know, things changed in the early 2000s. Bush had some free trade agreements that were under fire. Then we had the global financial crisis in 2008, 2009, and people thought protectionism might be coming back then and that free trade was a bad policy. So is every edition sort of just updates and refreshes it, but also it addresses some of the new problems that have come up.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's a great read because it is both a historical summary of the arguments against and but constantly updating. But you really get a sense of, you know, that history doesn't change. Right. Or I mean, maybe some of the terms change, but these arguments are still in place. Now we are faced with, you know, the second term of Donald Trump, a self-declared tariff man who at one point said tariff is the most beautiful word in the dictionary. He said he thinks it is more beautiful than the word love. What is Donald Trump promising in terms of tariffs in his second term?
Well, it's changed a little bit over time, sort of like the arguments over free trade. So during the campaign, he was saying we want a 10%, and then it went up to a 20% across the board tariff on everyone, all imports, plus a 60% tariff on China. And then after he was elected, it sort of shifted a bit, and he threatened 25% tariffs against Mexico and Canada, ostensibly for the flow of fentanyl and drugs across the border and the migration and things of that sort. And then only 10% against China. So I think we really don't know what will come January. It's sort of evolving.
It's really how much of the Big Mac is he digesting, right? A blood sugar spike might dictate this. What is amazing, too, is that he is specifically targeting. I mean, Canada, Mexico, and China aren't random countries, right? They're the three top trading partners with the U.S. We'll come back to, you know, what those, like the maximal versions of what he's talked about doing when he gets back in office in a bit. But what did he do in his first term and how did that affect the economy?
So he did a couple of things. First of all, he imposed steel tariffs on imported steel. That really wasn't too much of a surprise. You know, George W. Bush had done that. Ronald Reagan had done that. Richard Nixon had done something similar as well. So the steel industry, Pennsylvania and Ohio, swing states, very politically sensitive, Steel gets a lot of attention. We imposed special tariffs on about half of imports from China, that sort of ratcheted up, 7% going up to 20, 25% or so. We renegotiated NAFTA. Initially, he was going to just rip it up. It was the worst trade deal ever, he said.
Yeah.
But somehow he made it magically better because they really didn't change the text that much. But of course, we got rid of NAFTA as a name. Now it's known as USMCA, just sort of rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, very much.
U.S.
Yeah. Definite
Mexico
improvement.
Canada agreement. Nothing about trade, nothing about free.
Yeah.
But he did that. That's sort of about it. He had talked about doing some other things, but a little bit less than I think all the bluster going into his
You know, according to a tax policy foundation analysis, the tariffs that he put in place, and then interestingly, Biden, who kind of said, oh, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about, kept a lot of the tariffs in place. But that it costs, you know, the Trump tariffs from the first time around ended up adding about $80 billion in taxes to people, or increased cost by that. How, you know, per year. How do we feel that? Because, you know, most of us aren't buying steel, but, you know, how do these tariffs actually show up and how do they kind of cascade through the economy?
Well, even this Congressional Budget Office said the Trump tariffs would shave about 2.2% off of U.S. GDP. So it's not tipping us into a recession. And it's once again hard to know that, but we're sort of have a smaller GDP than we otherwise would have.
And that's 2.2% over a number of years?
No, that's just 0.2%.
0.2%, 0.2 of 1%.
Exactly. Yep.
And we're in an era where we might be growing, you know, at 2% total. So it's not a giant number, but it's not trivial either.
Exactly. Exactly. But you're right. What's interesting about the China tariffs is Tim Cook of Apple was very adroit in making sure that Apple products were not hit by those. So we didn't feel it in terms of buying iPhones and iPads and things of that sort. Consumer electronics were excluded. But if you were an industrial buyer of goods from China, you paid a higher price. And the steel tariffs, of course, that covered most imported sources. Steel prices did rise. And once again, as you point out, we don't go out as consumers and households and buy a bar of steel. But a lot of state and local governments buy a lot of steel to repair bridges. They had to pay more. That's us as taxpayers trying to fund that. That's for GM. Their costs go up to the extent they're producing in the U.S. because when they produce in Mexico, they had lower steel costs. They didn't have to pay those taxes there. So you might shift some production more to Canada and to Mexico. And then if you're Caterpillar or John Deere, you're buying a lot of steel. And of course, you're competing against Komatsu and other foreign entities that don't have to pay those taxes. So it's raising the cost of doing business in the U.S.
What is the effect generally? You know, we can talk about this in a more historical sense, but the Trump tariffs, is there an well understood effect on employment?
Not really. So one of the things if we're worried about the overall level of employment, the Fed is so much more important there and what's happening to interest rates. So if the Fed's tightening, slowing the economy, job growth is going to slow. If they reduce interest rates and pump money in, you know, at least in the short term, we'll get more hiring. But tariffs, we think that they just change prices in such a way that, you know, there's trade-offs. So we might create more steel jobs in the steel industry as a result of the steel tariffs. But as I mentioned, the auto industry, and if you're a big industrial consumer, you're probably going to have to shed some employment or you're going to move jobs elsewhere. So you sort of win some, you lose some. Same with sugar, for example, which I know Reason has written about quite a bit. You know, it's going to help sugar farmers, but we're going to offshore the candy industry. So we lose jobs there, we gain some here.
How much of, you know, the way Trump talks about it in particular, because he's very, you know, openly political about this stuff. If it's not so much in the aggregate, you know, that he's actually going to block stuff so that, you know, all steel in America is made in America, et cetera, and there's some renaissance in the steel industry, but rather, you know, Tim Cook has to go to him and say, hey, would you please not do this for my products? Is the history of being a tariff man, is that as much for gaining concessions, squeezing concessions out of people in America as it is foreign countries?
That's a great point. I don't think explicitly, but I think it's turned out to be that way. Someone once said that if you give the government discretion, someone's going to pay them to exercise that discretion. Mm-hmm. And what we saw with the first round of Trump tariffs during his first term was a lot of firms and industries petitioning the government for exemptions for various reasons. You know, we can't source this domestically or what have you. And so you do have to sort of suck up to the government to get exemptions. And that's been part of the process in the U.S. and certainly in other countries, too. The process of tariff setting is horribly corrupt.
Yeah. What's your biggest fear out of his new, his new proposals? Granted that, you know, when we're talking on, in mid-December, so things will be different by the time he actually gets into office and things like that. But what is your biggest fear about his recent, you know, kind of proclamations that helped him get elected to a second term?
Well, I think, he said we're going to do more against China. I think there's sort of bipartisan consensus that we're going to do something about China. So I'm not so worried about that. But I think once we levy, if we levied across the board tariffs, we're hitting our friends and our allies and our free trade partners. That's destructive because they really haven't done anything wrong. We benefit from the imports and the trade, the bilateral trade with them. There's going to be foreign retaliation. So that's going to hit U.S. exports and hurt certain segments of the U.S. economy. And then one of the lessons of history is tariffs and trade barriers are very easy or relatively easy to impose, but very hard to remove.
Can you explain that? Go ahead.
Once you've imposed those barriers, you have vested interests behind them. And the vested interests are going to fight tooth and nail to make sure that those things don't go away. So we see this with anti-dumping duties. Once you impose them, supposedly they're just for 5 years. But at the end of 5 years, the industry says, well, we need to re-up this another 5 years or so.
And anti-dumping laws are, you know, say that a foreign entity or, you know, somebody sending stuff here can't sell products below their cost or something along those
lines. Something like that. Yeah. There's a technical definition about price discrimination, actually.
Right.
But we saw this after World War II, a lot of protectionism during the Great Depression in the 1930s. It took about 4 or 5 decades to get back down to where we had been before. So it's not just the vested interest behind them, but then also governments will say, well, we need these as bargaining tools. We just don't want to give them away. So with the steel tariffs, which I think most economic analysis has shown has been damaging to the U.S. economy, the Biden administration, probably for political reasons too, didn't want to get rid of them because they said, well, this would be a giveaway to other countries. We now have to negotiate to get them lowered. And that takes time. So for various reasons, what goes up does not come down quite as easily or as fast.
Should we care that much about the steel industry in America? That, you know, that seems to always be where now I'm switching materials, but that's where the rubber hits the road, right? Where it's always, we need these steel jobs. Thinking of somebody like J.D. Vance, Trump's vice president, senator from Ohio, who grew up in a dead steel town, you know, which had in Middletown, Ohio, which had once been part of the steel belt. It's now part of the rust belt. Why do we fixate on something like steel?
I think politicians do because certain states are important for the votes. I think there's a nostalgia, of course. It's when America made things. It's when we were great. We think that, well, for national defense, tanks, drones don't need too much steel, but, you know, tanks and maybe fire jets do. So we sort of need this for protection in some sense of our national security. But I think, you know, well, we can get into the economics of it. It doesn't really make too much sense. In fact, the justification for the Trump steel tariffs was national security.
Right.
But even Jay Mattis of the Department of Defense, when they're asked to weigh in, the Department of Defense concluded there's no national security rationale for propping up imposing these tariffs on the steel industry because we talk about imports, but 3/4 of all the steel we consume, we produce here in the U.S. The import market share is only about 25%. So it may have risen from 20 to 25%. That was considered a disaster by steel producers, but that's hardly a national security emergency.
Yeah. And part of it is he invokes national security because then he can unilaterally levy a lot of stuff, right? He has more power as president. But, you know, to go back to this question of like, okay, well, we're actually producing most of the steel that we need. Should we produce less steel? Like, should we just be bringing it in from more places because it's cheaper?
That's an interesting issue. First of all, I should note that most of our imports come from our allies and friends, Japan, South Korea, Germany, Canada. So it's not as though, even if for national security reasons, we need to worry about where these imports are coming from. But you're right that The steel industry has changed quite a bit. What we have now in the U.S. are known as mini mills. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they don't start with raw iron ore and produce it from scratch. They're just taking, we have so much iron around, they're just sort of remelting it and reshaping it. So in some sense, we don't need as much of the integrated raw steel producers as we did in the past.
Tariffs are a tool of protectionism, right? Mm-hmm. So what is the effect of protectionism on jobs? Because this, and I apologize for the pun, but let's steel man these arguments. And I think a lot about J.D. Vance because he may well be the future, not just of the American political system, but of the Republican Party. And he has very outspoken views about this stuff. And he went on a rant that was widely circulated during the campaign about we need to bring jobs home in the manufacturing sector. And he talked about people who will give away our national sovereignty for $30 toasters. And when I heard that, I got to tell you, as somebody who I lived in Ohio for a long time, I was like, who pays $30 for a toaster? You can get you can get one for $9 at Walmart. But what is the effect of putting up protectionist policies around the country on unemployment? Because we're always told that we have lost all of our industrial jobs, which are the best jobs, overseas because of free trade.
Well, we haven't lost the jobs mainly because of trade. It's mainly been technological change, and the steel industry is a great case in point. So in the 1980s, it took 10 worker hours to produce a ton of steel. Now, demand for steel is not growing all that much, so we're producing just as much steel as we did in the past, but now it takes one worker hour to produce a ton of steel. And the type of jobs in the steel industry have changed. So in the 1980s, it was sort of Bruce Springsteen, born in the USA, blue-collar workers actually, shifting the molten lava to form bars or wires or rolled steel or what have you. Now, of course, it's all automated. So you hire an engineer from Carnegie Mellon who's monitoring all the equipment and just making sure things work, not a dozen guys that are just graduated from the local high school. So that's really the story of a lot of manufacturing. That was an important point. Tariffs don't help because you may help out production in the steel industry, but you're going to hurt production in other downstream industries that use steel. And it's a trade-off of jobs. It's not a net addition to manufacturing jobs. In fact, some economists have shown that we probably lost manufacturing jobs as a result of the steel tariffs.
Yeah, I guess overall, the idea is that the more trade we have and the more economic activity we have, regardless of what sector it's in, the more employment we have, and then wages are tied to productivity rather than it's not just, steel jobs are good jobs, or making auto parts or cars is a good job necessarily. It's really, are you more productive?
Absolutely. So I have a whole chapter in Free Trade Under Fire on this. And if you look at the correlation between the unemployment rate and imports as a share of GDP, they're almost perfectly negatively correlated. Mm-hmm. That is, when the unemployment rate is going up, imports are going down. And when the unemployment rate is going down, imports are going up as a share of the economy. And it's to your point, it's whether we're doing well as an economy, whether demand's strong, or whether we're going into a recession.
If Trump is a tariff man, he also hates automation, and just yesterday, actually, he went on a tear. He had talked with the head of the Longshoremen's Union, who, were threatening a strike earlier in the year. I was going to say the rise of containerization of shipping. I mean, if that's not even accurate, that's been going on for 70 years. But Trump said that, point blank, that automation is the biggest disaster to happen to the working man and that there's no benefit to it. How do you make the pitch to people who are going to be automated out of work, that this should happen and that it's for the greater good?
Well, obviously, those workers who are adversely affected, there's no getting around it. They're probably going to lose their jobs. Usually, this happens slowly over time. So it's through retirements and attrition rather than sort of mass firings. But the societal benefits are huge. Can you imagine, when would we stop automation? 1925, 1825? I mean, there's been a complaint going back to the Luddites in England in the early 1800s. And of course, we just can't first of all, we can't stop it. We wouldn't want to stop it because of all the material benefits. You know, just that argument about automation and jobs reminds me of that Milton Friedman story, which I'm sure you've heard, where he was visiting India, watching some people digging with shovels. And he said, why use some mechanization to move the earth to build this road? And he said, oh, we'd lose so many jobs then. He said, oh, well, why don't you give them spoons then? You'd need many more workers if you gave them spoons instead of shovels.
Has the attitudes towards these types of, you know, towards automation and trade, and, you know, and it's always been a mix, but are we in a darker place, a more pessimistic place about the ability of trade or automation to increase, you know, kind of overall productivity and economic activity where everybody benefits?
A bit, but I think you're right. We had these cycles. So if you go back to the early 1960s and look at some of the covers of Time magazine, and the Kennedy administration was very worried about automation and the loss of jobs. There are pictures of robots, very crude robots from the 60s taking over jobs. But I think in the 80s and 90s, we sort of got comfortable with the fact that, my gosh, the benefits of computerization and electronics all these innovations are really good for the economy, and things were going pretty well. And now maybe we're moving to a different place where we've, you know, worried about manufacturing jobs as a share of employment, things of that sort. So I think there's a natural cycle in some sense to these things.
What I mean, can you explain a bit because about, you know, why do we at different points we worry, you know, we have national conversations over the percentage of people who work in factories or in the industrial sector. But basically, since the mid 40s, it's been a straight line decline. You know, there were peaks, you know, because of World War II. And then we were, you know, we had a lot of big industries that were protected by tariffs, you know, things like steel, things like the automobile industry. It was also true that Europe was rebuilding and Asia was yet to grow into an economic powerhouse itself. So we could export a lot. But, you know, if there's a pretty straight, steady decline in the number of people who are working in factories, what intervenes to say, oh my God, now it's, you know, it's an epidemic? Because I'm old enough. I was born in 63. And, you know, and I, like I said, I've lived in Ohio. I mostly grew up on the East Coast, but I remember at least three distinct panics over this is the end, you know, this is the deindustrialization of America. But it's, you know, it's just been getting lower and lower my entire life.
Yeah. In fact, one of the formative books of my youth was a book, Brookings book, published by Robert Lawrence in the late 1970s when I was sort of thinking about economics. And it was called Can America Compete? And that's the late 1970s. That worries about foreign competition from then Japan and Germany, whether they were having our lunch because they were so much better at, cars or what have you than we were. But you're right. That's a remarkable picture of the share of employment in manufacturing, which is just this downward sloping line since the 1940s. You know, you say, where is NAFTA on this? Where is China entering the world trading system? You couldn't see it because there's not even a blip. It's just a straight line. And what's interesting about that, it's driven by productivity, not trade. And we know that because since 2010 or so, that line is flattened out. In other words, the share of employment in manufacturing has not declined. And this is occurring at a time when manufacturing productivity is not improving. So if we want the jobs, we're not going to have the productivity. If we want the productivity, because that's important for future living standards and the expansion of the economy, we're not going to have the jobs. So it's sort of a trade-off. It's interesting. No one really worried about the loss of farm jobs. Right. Throughout American history, you go back,
or at least not when we were alive, right? Because that, I mean, that shift started happening in a big way in the 20s, and you know, now it's what, like 1% of the population or something is directly involved in the production of food. But if you go back and if you read, kind of novels and whatnot, there is a concern over people leaving the countryside and going to the city. I mean, because it was disruptive, but we do. The myth of the American farmer as the backbone of the American economy still exists, right?
Yeah, in some sense, we've protected agriculture for many, many years, way before manufacturing. So it could be just declining sectors in terms of employment. There's a natural political response to try to protect them with some sort of public policy.
Can we afford protectionism? I guess is one way of framing a question because, it's $80 billion a year, say, the current set of tariffs that have been put in place since about 2017, you know, our economy is 26, you know, $30 trillion, you know, give or take, you know, that's a drop in the bucket. Should we, you know, why should we care about giving this to, you know, to the people who want it?
Well, in some sense, you're right in the terms of the premise of your question. We can get away with it more than other countries because trade is, we're the world's largest economy, and trade is a relatively small share of the U.S. economy. Imports are about 14%, exports are about 10, 11, 12% of U.S. GDP. Compare that to Canada, compare that to Belgium, compare that to Zambia, compare that to Malaysia. Those countries are much more dependent on trade. So when they engage in protectionism, the costs are much more apparent. And it's much more damaging to their economy. So because trade is a relatively small share of the U.S. economy, we can sort of get away with these things and not really feel it too much. But for small open economies, the consequences can be quite devastating.
One of the arguments against free trade, you know, as it's called, like where, you know, unilaterally giving up on tariffs and things like that, is that, you know, we let other countries, and, you know, right now we're, it's all about China. China subsidizes so many of its companies. China subsidizes its exports, you know, and so we're in an unfair, it's not a level playing field. Is that, you know, is that an accurate critique and it's just that it gets overwhelmed by other benefits, or is that fundamentally flawed as well?
Well, there's definitely true that China intervenes and helps out its export-oriented industries through implicit subsidies for the financial system and credit that they don't have to pay back, or we don't know the terms and things of that sort. So it is a very distorted economy, but we have to think about, does that hurt us or does it help us? Someone said if solar panels just were washing up on the shore of California or coast of New Jersey, would we destroy them and keep them out? Or would we say, gosh, free solar panels? Maybe we should install these and take advantage of them. So there's always going to be this debate about when foreign countries subsidize their exports, whether we should write them a thank you note, or whether it's causing political problems or problems for certain industries that we need to help.
Let's talk a bit about the historical episodes that are, you know, in both the reissuing of trade policy disaster, as well as some of the cases in free trade under fire. Let's talk about Smoot-Hawley, because this is something, you know, and you realize as one gets older, you realize that the things that you thought were, you know, some events that were always going to be important and central to America or to the society you live in just don't matter anymore. And the Depression and even World War II or, you know, are some of those things. But Smoot-Hawley was a shorthand, particularly if you were of a libertarian bent, of just the dumbest sorts of responses to economic problems. And Smoot-Hawley was a series of tariffs that went into place after the Wall Street crash and helped both, you know, was a response to and helped create and intensify the Great Depression. Can you talk a little bit about what happened under Smoot-Hawley and what is the bigger principle that it really represents?
Yeah. Fortunately, Smoot-Hawley still has cultural relevance because of the scene in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where Ben Stein plays the boring high school teacher and goes on this riff, which apparently was unscripted, they just said, talk about something boring. He said, tariff policy, that's probably it.
And there, and you were in the audience saying, like, that's what I'm going to do for my life.
Exactly, yeah. Affected different people different ways, I guess. No, but you used the right term, dumb. It was completely unnecessary because actually the Republicans proposed this in the 1928 presidential election campaign. The economy was humming along. You know, this is the roaring 20s. Unemployment was very low. We weren't being besieged by imports. There's no real reason for this legislation. And I can go into the politics of it a bit. And it had to do with the farm sector. Farm sector wasn't doing so well. So they thought, well, we'll just have this targeted increase in tariffs for farm goods. First of all, that's even misguided because most farmers were export oriented. And if the prices were low, tariffs isn't going to help them on that side. But then it sort of spun out of control. So once the manufacturers heard that the farmers might get higher tariffs, then they said, of course, we want something more as well. And so no one was really happy with it at the end of the day. It didn't really help out farmers. It didn't really wasn't necessary for manufacturers, but President Hoover signed it. And here's where the residents for today is important. Everyone, members of Congress and the administration would say, you know what, this is just domestic legislation. It doesn't really matter for the rest of the world. But it turns out the rest of the world really cared. They retaliated against the U.S. So that's a key important point. When we impose our tariffs, it's not just, it doesn't stop there. Other countries respond in kind. We saw that with our first Trump term quite a bit with China and the EU and others retaliating.
How you talk? What was the biggest retaliatory step that China took, against the Trump tariffs?
Imposing tariffs on various. First of all, a big one they could do is their airlines. They can sort of coerce them to say, buy Airbus, not Boeing.
Yeah.
Of course, those are big ticket items. They said, okay, guess what? We're not going to buy American soybeans anymore. We'll get them from Brazil or Argentina or some other source. These are things that there's a lot of substitutes out there. And so it's very easy to substitute away from the U.S. on some of these products. And of course, it's very hard to regain the market share if the retaliatory tariffs go away. Right. But that's the damage that they do. It hits U.S. exports and the jobs and the production behind them.
To move forward a little bit through time, after World War II, the United States, emerges from that, and from the rubble of World War II as a global hegemon, both politically and militarily, but also economically, partly because, Japan, which was a big economy, was flattened and, Europe was really on its back. Is a cynical take that we started pushing free trade because we had a lot of stuff to sell and those guys weren't sending us a lot. Is that an accurate take or if it is accurate, is it really beside the point because, a move towards more global trade was good for everybody?
Well, when you look at the debates of the time, politicians in the U.S., economists in states in the U.S., all sorts of arguments were being made. That one certainly came up. We benefit from this now because everyone's been laid low. But I think that that's a little bit uncharitable. I think the U.S. really did generally want to ensure that World War II was the last war. We didn't want World War III because now nuclear weapons were around. We wanted the link between economic prosperity and peace had sort of been codified during the 1930s when we saw that, the two were not in hand. So we want to revive the European economy to help out the prospects for peace, as well as rebuild our export markets.
And as you point out in Free Trade Under Fire, though, I mean, we did push in things like, GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs or Tariffs and Trade. It didn't include the Soviet Union or their sphere of influence. So in another way, it was also, it eventually gets there, but we were really... there's a political and geopolitical element to this as well as economic.
Absolutely. So when you look at the initial post-war period, really right up until 1989, the fall of the Berlin Wall and the subsequent collapse of the Soviet Union, we were not one integrated world. We really had three worlds. And of course, there were those terms. First world, Western Europe, North America, Japan, and our allies, Western-oriented capitalist democracies. The second world, the Soviet Union, China, Cuba, Vietnam, and others. Then the third world, developing countries in Latin America and Africa and South Asia, which really protected themselves because they wanted to have import substituting policies to jumpstart industrialization. So what we talk about freer trade, it was really just sort of Western Europe, United States, and Japan in some sense. The rest of the world was behind. That's why 1989 to 91 was such a revolution because all of a sudden, the Eastern Bloc opened up, developing countries began to open up, obviously China and India being the two biggest and most important ones. And we had this very brief period from, say, the early 1990s until maybe the global financial crisis where everyone was sort of on the same page of being open for trade, open for investment. And now we're back into geopolitics, U.S.-China tensions, and other countries rethinking their policies for security reasons or other reasons.
What, having said that, the 90s, Ronald Reagan, started the beginnings of what became NAFTA. H.W. Bush pushed it along, and then it was Bill Clinton and Al Gore famously debating H. Ross Perot on the old Larry King show, kind of sealed the deal on that. So there was a lot of friction. And as you alluded to earlier, by the end of the 90s, there was this whole movement against the World Trade Organization, which was going to globalize and integrate the economy in a way that, you know, many, you know, people who believe in kind of economic freedom and capitalism thought was going to be good. There was a pushback against that. What were the big arguments against things like NAFTA and the development and implementation of the World Trade Organization?
So with regard to NAFTA, it was sort of critiques on the left and the right. So I'm not sure where we put Perot on the political spectrum, but Pat Buchanan, the Republican Party, he was very much against it, which is sort of, that's an early Trump, Trumpist view on trade.
Oh, yeah. He's kind of like, you know, the almost the John the Baptist of the Trump movement, right? Because he was, against, you know, Mexicans and immigration. He was against trade, certainly. And he kind of embodied or personified the politics of resentment and political attacks. Yeah.
Yep. And then the Democrats were very suspicious of NAFTA because their political support was coming from labor unions, and unions thought they were the, sort of the target that would be hit with importing products made with low-wage Mexican labor. So that's sort of a traditional, you know, opposition to trade based on sort of cultural concerns about, you know, letting other countries' goods in, and then the real concerns of organized labor. And then in terms of the WTO, it was sort of the same thing. Sort of left and right had their own different critiques. On the right, is we're creating this monster that's going to, we're giving up our sovereignty, and discharging powers to Geneva instead of keeping them in Washington D.C. And then, of course, on the left, it was more, well, this is going to overrun our domestic regulations regarding the environment and health and safety, and we won't have any, you know, appeal and control over these things. We're giving up our sovereignty on that, those regulations.
Those were the arguments. Yeah, what won the day? Because, you know, both NAFTA and then the WTO, you know, these became the law. What were the arguments that kind of convinced people?
I think with regard to the WTO first, it's the attacks were just exaggerated. It wasn't going to create this all-powerful Geneva, overseer of the world trading system. It's just a set of processes and a set of rules that which they couldn't really enforce on us, and also a lot of exceptions for health and safety standards. So it really wasn't compromising things the way a lot of the critics pointed out. With NAFTA, I think it was foreign policy. Here we have this neighbor that's struggling, Mexico. We've always had problems with them. We didn't propose free trade with them. Because they would have rejected instantly, the Yankee imperialists coming in to dominate our markets. Right. We had to wait for them. They wanted it because they were in the process of reforming their economy, moving more towards markets. And for us to say, you know what? No, we don't want to help you out. That was just sort of a non-starter. I mean, I think that there's a story that Colin Powell actually said, you know, if Mexico doesn't get its political act together sometime, we're going to have to call out troops to monitor the border because it's just going to be chaos and people will be coming across. And the idea was, actually, a great way to stop migration is to create a flourishing Mexican economy where people can be employed there and prosper.
Did they, you know, did Mexico prosper as a result of NAFTA?
Not nearly as much as people anticipated and hoped. And I think this just shows, people said this is a failure of NAFTA. Well, to have a well-performing economy, you need a lot of things going on that's going well. You need a rule of law, a good judicial system, enforcement of contracts. And of course, we've seen the drug trade, we've seen the cartels, we've seen some questionable macroeconomic policies. So the trade part is done reasonably well. There's a flourishing maquiladoro, and northern Mexico is doing reasonably okay. But the whole it's not enough. Just doing that is not enough to make for a prosperous society.
China becomes a major issue. After the Seattle protests and things like that, then we started talking about the China shock or the China effect, that it was a mistake to let China into the WTO and give it most favored nation status, et cetera. How has China entering global markets and particularly engaging with the U.S., how has that affected things? Is it as big a shock to employment, to prices, to everything, as we often hear?
It changed quite a bit. But remember, what they initially were taking over is sort of low-end manufacturing. Mm-hmm. So mainly, basically assembly and apparel and textiles. So yes, of course, we lost some jobs in the South. So you know, when we talk about manufacturing jobs, a lot of them move from the north to the south. Mm-hmm. But once they're in the south, if they leave, they go elsewhere. And so textiles and apparel was one where it's really, you can't really mechanize your way into producing shirts and shoes. It's still very labor intensive. So we lost those jobs, but those tend to be very low paying jobs in the U.S. And a lot of those workers, some were displaced and didn't do well, but others found jobs in the service sector that paid them equally well, if not better. But certainly it's revolutionized world trade because they're just such over a billion people. You're giving them mm-hmm. access to better technology. It's created a huge demand for both, not just U.S. exports, but Australia's prospered, New Zealand, other Southeast Asian countries. It's enormous development. Of course, the reduction in poverty is just astonishing.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, if you're J.D. Vance and you say, but like I look around Ohio and all I see are shuttered up factories or factories that are kind of limping along and then they bring in low wage workers, you know, from Haiti or whatever, who are eating cats on the side and then taking jobs that, Americans should have. What's wrong with that critique?
There's a grain of truth. There's that line that Al Gore used in that debate with Ross Perot. There's a grain of truth to that, but it's not the whole truth. So the truth is we've lost a lot of jobs, a lot more jobs because of mechanization than because of trade. But there's certainly the case that there was an adjustment in certain industries, furniture production, textiles and apparel in particular, maybe auto parts and a few other sectors as well, where we are importing a lot more from China. Now, once again, that's those lower prices have made our final goods producers much more competitive. And so if you want to keep Ford and GM afloat, you can't saddle them with a very inefficient supply network through protection. So it's adjusting to a new world. And the question is, how do we do that? And what's the role for the government to facilitate that?
What do you think? You know, let's talk about the financial crisis. Which was another major blow. And after the financial crisis, there's also a lot of talk about, okay, you know what, we need to erect trade barriers to, and maybe let our goods out, but we should be charging people more because we got our own people to take care of. How did the financial crisis change the debate or re-enliven it? About trade.
It's very important that you brought that up because when you look at the big drops in employment and manufacturing, the biggest one, of course, is the financial crisis of 2008-2009. And I think that's really conflated with trade, partly because it's occurring around the time when China was really growing and dominating things. And the impact is much more long-lasting. So the recovery from that was very slow and very painful, particularly in the Rust Belt. So I think there's not too much we can do to rerun history and get rid of the financial crisis, but there is something we could do about trade. So I think even though the biggest harm was done because of the financial crisis, the remedy turns to trade, even if it's only 10%.
Because that's the thing you can look at and say, okay, we're going to change our policy there.
Exactly. Yep.
So does the future belong to kind of, a global agreement on tariffs and trade, or is it, are we starting to move into new spheres of influence? So, there's obviously the North America context, there's the BRICS kind of growing coalition of, some countries in Latin America as well as Asia and whatnot. There's the EU, which has been floating around, and the EU, obviously has some preferential treatments to members of that, as opposed to people from outside. Do you worry that we will, or maybe we are already doing this, so that we're going into bigger trade blocks rather than kind of universal globalization in trade?
I think we're certainly moving in that direction. And once again, if you compare the period after we created the WTO, we're talking about the late 1990s, early 2000s, geopolitics really wasn't a major factor. I mean, mm-hmm. Russia was just trying to stabilize. China was just trying to get rich. And after the global financial crisis, we're really in a different era where national security is important, not just in the U.S., but obviously Western Europe with the invasion of Ukraine. They're much more worried about their defense establishment. They have to increase defense expenditures. They're worried about, who are their allies that they can rely on. China's moved inward. Xi Jinping is not Deng Xiaoping. He's the one who's really taken China in a very different direction. become much more economically isolationist and wants to be self-sufficient and self-dependent. So I think you do, in times of stress and when risks go up, countries tend to turn inward. So I think, unfortunately, we're in this period when countries are looking for these blocks of like-minded countries and are turning inward to some extent.
You know, one instance of, you know, I struggle with, I'm very interested in immigration and trade issues, and I like openness more than closeness. And, you know, it's funny because, I mean, if you hang out with libertarians or market-oriented people, they're like, well, who doesn't? But in fact, that, you know, a lot of people don't, and it's important to understand that and to have, you know, have ways of engaging that. During COVID, one of the things that came up was like, okay, well, we, you know, there are global supply chains, and, you know, when those get disrupted, everything gets screwed up. And one of the, you know, one of the reactions to that is to say, that's why we need to have more of the supply chain in America, because that way it doesn't matter what happens overseas. Like, we can control our own destiny. So if you can stick with me with this, you know, we also had, you know, in recent memory now, some, you know, shortages of foodstuffs that are, you know, were unimaginable even during the worst years, worst parts of the 70s and things like that. But like, you know, baby formula in America was, you know, virtually all baby formula is made, you know, in a couple of factories in America. And then because of regulations on it, we can't really import baby formula from overseas, which is, you know, as good, if not better, you know, than what we're producing. And, you know, different people have different preferences. Can you talk a little bit about how that baby formula shortage, where there, you know, there were people, you know, just roaming around supermarkets all over the country looking for baby formula, you know, in recent memory, how free trade would alleviate that kind of problem?
It's amazing that the public message or the ones that politicians have been pushing is so contrary to sort of the facts of the situation, where people say, well, because we ran out of baby formula, it just shows we need to, you know, have things produced here. Well, it's precisely because we were producing things here and one plant gets shut down that we had this shortage, and the fact we didn't allow imports to come in. So imports are a great relief mechanism for when there's surges in demand or a domestic problem in terms of importing goods. That's where we got a lot of masks initially before we went up domestic production.
From China, right, of all places.
From China, yes. Yeah. And so it just shows you when you're an open economy, much more diversified in terms of where you get things, and any particular supply shock doesn't affect you quite as much as if you're dependent on just domestic sourcing for particular goods.
To kind of wrap up, you've been at university. How long have you been teaching at universities and colleges?
For more than 30 years.
Okay. So what is the generational, kind of component to attitudes towards trade? Or is there a generational component? Because this is also something, you know, we're roughly the same age. And so we grew up in a kind of post-war glow on a certain level, and where, you know, we probably had parents or grandparents who could remember the Depression. And certainly mine didn't understand the intricacies of Smoot-Hawley, but they knew that tariffs, you know, were kind of ridiculous, and they didn't help, if in fact they didn't help, really hurt. And that opening things up, I mean, my father worked for a shipping company, for God's sake. So like, he understood, you know, goods moving across national borders is generally a good thing. But then we have all of these other things, most recently, you know, COVID and the financial crisis in 2008. How does that affect attitudes towards things like trade, do you think?
It's a very interesting question. And I think when I think back to some of the students I had in the 1990s and the 2000s, they were imbued with an optimism. And they sort of took it for granted that, you know, yes, the end of history, global capitalism, moving towards democracy, that sort of way the world's going, and free trade's just part of that. And I think students now, over the past 10 years, because of the financial crisis, because of concerns about China, are much more questioning of that and are unsure of it. Most undergraduates, when you're 19 or 20, don't know a lot about trade and tariff policy. But you're coming in from a different position, I think, today than you were 20 years ago or so.
What about things like, you know, if you're a millennial or a younger, well, Gen Z, it's kind of more complicated. But, you know, on a certain level, compared to baby boomers or Gen X, You know, millennials actually are doing quite well when you look at per capita wealth and, you know, household ownership and things like that. Certainly education levels are much higher. They also, not only did they go through the financial crisis, which really revealed how either stupid or uncaring, you know, many of our leaders were and ignorant, like many of our policy leaders. But there's also a foreign policy component to that, where, you know, 20 years of kind of, you know, let's be charitable and just say ineffective military interventions around the world. How does that factor in? And does trade move in concert with, you know, attitudes towards war, attitudes towards immigration, things like that? Or is it its own thing?
They are related. I haven't thought systematically about how they are, but you're right. During that period, the 1990s and the 2000s, national security wasn't a high priority.
Right.
And so free trade just seemed like, let's go for the prosperity and the economic benefits. And now that it's sort of on the agenda, tariffs and what have you, and that we're fearful of China to some extent, fearful of America's position in the world, there's fear about dependency on others and the security of supply chain. So the two sort of go hand in hand. I will say one thing about the younger generation today. They're very addicted to their guacamole and their coffee in the morning.
Right.
And so they're very aware that we don't produce these things. And
I was
so,
thinking about when you started talking about Mexico and NAFTA, I was like, oh yeah, that's why we eat so many avocados now, right?
Yes.
And they're avocado, different and better. The Hess avocado, you know, generally mostly ends up being grown in Mexico. And I can remember the 80s and walking around Manhattan and you would find, I think they're now called Florida avocados, those giant green things that never tasted good, right?
Guacamole. They never ripened, right? They're always hard. And,
yeah, it was a color, you know, for like, you know, you're a man of refrigerator or something like that. You didn't eat avocados.
Exactly. So they all have their backpack with their Apple laptop, mm-hmm. manufactured in China, their iPhone, assembled in China, not made there, as you know, it says on the back.
You make a point of, you know, calling that out in Free Trade Under Fire, what is the difference between made in China and assembled in China? And why does Apple insist on that particular locution?
Because, you know, 6% of the iPhone is, quote unquote, made in China. That is value added in China, Chinese components. But it's the final place where all these components come from all around the world. So camera lens can come from Germany. The microchips come from Japan, South Korea. We add some of the software and actually some of the hardware as well. It all goes to China for final assembly, just really putting it together. It's not a Chinese product.
Right.
As I said, only 6% of the value accrues to China. This also leads to misleading trade statistics with China, because when that comes in as a $200 or $300 unit value import cost, that's all attributed to China, but only about, you know, as I said, 7 to 10% or so actually was from China. It's really parts from Japan and elsewhere around the world.
And then on the flip side of that, there's also, you know, Trump has certainly talked about this before him. Obama did during his stimulus plans, and Biden as well, like Buy America provisions. Those are often as misleading as the idea that the iPhone is a Chinese product, right?
Yeah, those tend to be with regard to government contracts for the steel that goes into the bridges that the state and local governments are buying and things of that sort, which, once again, just raises the cost of doing these things and costs us as taxpayers and also maybe slows down the projects.
Yeah, and I know, I'm thinking back now a dozen years at Reason, we did a video, this was part of the stimulus spending or, you know, some of the Obama stuff of, you know, buying American. And I think it was that the Jeep Patriot was more made outside of the country than the whatever the Toyota equivalent was, because the Toyota had more plants in America and was doing more of the assembling here. But if you were looking at it from a very superficial level, it would seem like, well, you want the Jeep Patriot because it's made by an American company and it says it's patriotic, but are deceived.
The nameplate doesn't mean too much
right.
In terms of whether it's an American brand or a Japanese brand or a European brand. It's really where it's made, and that's different. Like a lot of the stuff that Trump sells, a lot of, you know, cheap junk, a lot of it's made in China, I suspect.
That's right. Yeah. And well, and this will be, I mean, how do you think things will work out with, you know, if Elon Musk, you know, the head of Tesla, which is largely done in China, I mean, you know, the mental work and a lot of the engineering and everything is not necessarily, but, you know, it's interesting to have somebody who has so much invested in China and then working with Donald Trump, who has seems to be saying so much about we have to stop China. And certainly, I guess this answers itself. People like Joe Biden put heavy tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles, but not necessarily Tesla ones. But how does this shake out? How do we get to a different conversation about tariffs and trade where we're not talking about it as a zero-sum game, and we're not talking about it as giving away American sovereignty in order to let people have a wider access to a bigger variety of goods that are going to be at multiple price points?
You can always make that case, and I've certainly tried over the years, but I think it might be the corruption of that's inherent in protectionism and government favoritism for certain special interests that sort of undermines the case more than pointing out some economic calculation about the dollar benefit to consumers. Yeah. When you see the favoritism, certain firms. So, for example, you raise a great point about Tesla in China. Is the Trump administration going to be principled in its anti-China stance, or is it going to say it's we make deals and we make a special deal here and we'll exempt Apple there? And because there's no real principle about China. It's more that, you know, if the company themselves pay us off or help us out in some way, they can get free from this. So I guess principles versus deals, that will determine something about how, you know, popular these policies will be.
Yeah. What's the best way to evaluate trade policy ultimately? Like at what point do we know enough about, you know, particular policies that we say, okay, this is working or it's not and it needs to be torn up? You know, how do we evaluate that? And then who are the free traders that are left in Congress or in business these days?
Well, the first one, how do we evaluate it? I think we have to be very careful before we take steps, because as I mentioned earlier, once you take a step, it's very hard to undo. So I don't know that you've heard of the Merino, it's not the Merino goats. It's the, there's a certain goat that produces a certain type of wool. Right. That we thought was really essential during the Korean War, and so in the
1960s, oh, is this mohair
goat? Yes, yeah, that's exactly it. Right. Yes. And of course, if you're a senator from Montana, you were very much in favor of this subsidy. Well, the Korean War, cold climate, we get the wool and stuff. The Korean War is over. We're fighting more in the Middle East these days. Yeah. It's pretty warm. We don't need wool, but that subsidy has persisted. The Clinton administration, to its credit, tried to get rid of it, but I think they only succeeded for a year or two, and then somehow the mohair goat subsidy got back in the process. So, and we'll see this with the tariffs on EVs and other things. Once we impose these things, very, very difficult to walk them back. So I guess the principle of trade policy is, for me, is that you have to be very clear about what your objective is and are the steps you're taking to achieve that objective the right ones. So one problem I see with the Trump administration is they have a multiplicity of objectives they want to achieve. They want to raise revenue through tariffs. They want to strike back against other countries. They want to reduce the trade deficit. They want to combat foreign unfair trade practices. They want to bring back jobs. That's a lot of different objectives that you're putting on this one policy instrument that's really not so fine-tuned to doing that. And so I think you're going to fail if you try to achieve multiple things. So, you know, there have been strategic uses of tariffs in the past or threats of tariffs that have brought other countries to the bargaining table or allowed us to achieve certain objectives. But it was very limited, targeted, not sort of broad brush.
Right. Who are the big free traders in, political and economic life these days?
You know, it's a pretty quiet bunch, unfortunately. I think partly because national security, to the extent that's invoked, it's very hard for economists to say we should ignore that. No one's really saying that. The question is costs and benefits, and are you doing the right thing? But there are certain members of Congress whose constituents are still dependent on exports, particularly in farm states. That are, first of all, they always get hit first when there's foreign retaliation. They benefit from agreements such as NAFTA, which have allowed American farmers to sell more into Mexico. They are quietly, resistant to a lot of the trade threats that have been going on, but they're not really standing up and speaking in favor of freer trade. And in academia, I think most economists are still broadly supportive of free trade and open markets, but it's just a very difficult and challenging environment when national security is of concern. Right. No one really likes China anymore.
Yeah.
And you have the president making all these threats.
Yeah. And I guess you throw on top of all of that, which is already more than enough, the, you know, we don't have a clear national identity. And suddenly, if you're saying, okay, well, we're open to everything from everywhere, you know, what's left of America? I mean, you hear this quite a bit, right?
Absolutely. Yep. And probably it's, you know, we were in favor of trade liberalization and open markets during the Cold War because it was a way of strengthening an alliance system. And once we don't sort of need that anymore in the post-Cold War period, although we're sort of moving back to that with the tensions with China, you sort of lose the foreign policy aspect of trade policy.
Well, on that a wonderful note, we're going to end this conversation. I've been talking with Douglas Irwin. He's the author, most recently, of Trade Policy Disaster, Lessons from the 1930s. And there's also a great, relatively recent edition of Free Trade Under Fire available everywhere. Doug, thanks so much for talking.
Always fun to chat. Thanks so much.